Hello, hello. Thank you for coming. Good afternoon, and I hope that this room is still air-conditioned so we are not suffering from Stanford's inability to cool the campus in this room. I'm Eric Wakin, Deputy Director of the Hoover Institution and the Robert H. Malott Director of our Library and Archives. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to today's film screening, Women of the Gulag, and the follow-up conversation with Paul Gregory and the director of the film, Mariana Yarovskaya. More on the program in a moment. Let me welcome you to the Hoover Institution and the lovely Traitel Auditorium, and to offer some thanks to the people who make this event and everything we do at the Hoover Institution possible. I want to thank our director, Tom Gilligan, for his support of the Library and Archives and our programming and of the whole institution. And importantly, to the overseers of the Hoover Institution. These are our board of directors and other donors. Everything we do at the Hoover Institution is privately funded, and without the generosity of our supporters, we would not be able to do anything. So we are eternally grateful to their support. I'd also like to thank our co-sponsor for this event, the Stanford University Libraries, and its director, Mike Keller. So, why are we here in this lovely building on the lovely campus? We're here at the Hoover Institution because of the vision of one man, and that is Herbert Hoover, who was in the first graduating class of Stanford University, and in 1919 gave $50,000 to the university. That's in purchasing power today, for those of you who are economists, about $750,000. He sent a telegram with his donation with a few words in it. Among them were, quote, collect material on war, unquote. That was his deed of gift, if you will, that endowment for what became the Hoover War Library and the institution that grew into the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace. So since then, Mr. Hoover's important donation in 1919, and we are in our centennial year this year, and in fact, in April of 1919, Mr. Hoover sent the telegram, so we celebrate our centennial based on the date, April 19th, that he sent his telegram. We've since grown into the world's largest organization to document war, revolution, and peace. And in addition to Library and Archives, of course, which is my great love, is the institution, which is also a great love. We are a robust research center focusing on ideas defining a free society. And the institution has well over 170 fellows working on economics, history, political science, literature, science, as well as fellows from the armed services. So we're a kind of interesting, unique research center or think tank with the Library and Archives and a world-renowned fellowship. Mr. Hoover said this about our mission. He said, quote, this institution is not and must not be a mere library. But with these purposes as its goal, the institution must dynamically point the road to peace, to personal freedom, and to the safeguards of the American system. And we remain true to Mr. Hoover's vision today. With that introduction, let me tell you a bit about the film, which we'll see in a moment. Women of the Gulag had its origins in the Hoover Library and Archives in Paul Gregory's book project of the same name, which was published by Hoover Press. Paul and the film's director, Mariana Yarovskaya, joined forces 6 years ago at the Library and Archives workshop on authoritarian regimes and democratic breakdown. And the result is this film. After premiering in New York and Hollywood, Women of the Gulag was shortlisted in the documentary short subject category in the 2019 Academy Awards. It has also shown, among many other places, at the Moscow Film Festival, at the Barbican Center in London, and it's remarkable that the film has just been bought by a Russian network for showing in June. Briefly about our two speakers, and we can welcome them with some applause now and later. Paul Gregory is a longstanding Hoover Institution research fellow, known for his prize-winning publications on the Stalin economy and repression. Mariana Yarovskaya graduated from Moscow State University in journalism and from USC's film school, where she received a Student Academy Award for directing. She's worked for NASA and National Geographic and has participated in several documentaries that received Academy Awards. Our program tonight we will show the film, which lasts about 50 minutes. Paul and Mariana will join us on the stage, and we'll take questions. There are microphones lined up, so after the film, you can line up the microphones. I will move the questioning along. So if I just ask you to please give a warm Hoover welcome to the film and our speakers, and we'll do the speakers again after this, please. With that, let's dim the lights and watch the film. Thank you. So Paul and Marianne are going to sit down, offer a few remarks, and then be happy to answer questions at the microphones if you'd like to step up there.
I hope I'm turned on. Am I turned on? I believe so. I'd like to begin by recognizing people in the audience, just a few of you, who were instrumental in making this film happen. Lisa Esser, are you here, Lisa? Perhaps not Igor Urunov. There's Igor. Laura Soroka. There's Laura. Catherine Jalik. Hello, Catherine. Natalia Reshetova. She's around. There she is, yeah. Mike McFowell, he was going to come, but perhaps he's not here. Maria Kurakina. And Cynthia Haven. And I apologize to all those who also helped us out, and we've forgotten. By the way, are there any crowdfunders here? Okay, thank you very much. Eric already explained in the introduction how Marianne and I got together. This is a remarkable event that unites the Hoover archives, which I used to write the book, and Hollywood, which is represented by Marianne. And we're very grateful that the film has had such a good reception. We will go soon to the Q&A, but Marianne is just back from a month and a half in Europe, mainly in Moscow, talking about the film and presenting the film. So maybe she could say a few words about that.
Thank you very much for coming. And it was actually very interesting to show the film in Moscow. We were largely ignored by Russian media up until the Academy Awards shortlist campaign nomination. The first media that actually reported about us was Voice of America. And you know, everybody sort of fell silent. And then suddenly, Democratic media picked up, you know, like Echo of Moscow or Rain radio station. And then finally, suddenly Moscow Film Festival invited us to come. And we had a special screening there. And after a little bit, Russian Channel 1 contacted us and said that they would like to purchase the film. They said, we want to maybe alter 5% of the film, maybe a couple of shots in the end. but otherwise, we would like to show the film. By the way, we're showing here a slightly longer version. This is a 53-minute version. The shortlisted one was 40 minutes. So it was just the same characters, just a little bit more concise. The interesting thing about screening in Moscow was that actually out of the six characters that you see here, almost all of them died in the course of finishing the film. And the first one to go was, of course, the woman, the lady, Ksenia, who is almost 100, who walks away in the end. Then the piano player, who hears Tchaikovsky in the camp, she died 2 years ago. Then Fokla, the peasant with frogs in her mouth, she actually lived until, you know, we actually got Oscar shortlist, and we called to kind of share with her and explain what it is. And the neighbors said that she died. And then Adil is 99 now, and she's completely blind and deaf. And the film was shown in Suhumi. They asked us to change the name of the city from Suhumi to Suhum, and we refused to do that. So there's this, and her family came. But she's not capable of. Yelena Posnik, the one who speaks many languages and worked in Kolyma, is paralyzed, but she's alert. So she couldn't come and see, but her relatives came. And the only person who could be brought to the Moscow screening was Solzhenitsyn's assistant, Nadezhda Levitskaya. She was in a wheelchair, and they actually put her on stage. And the interesting part about screening in Moscow, had we been nominated for an Academy Award, none of them could have made it. But they actually brought the wheelchair on stage, and she got her standing ovations, which is what all these women deserve. and would not get otherwise. And she got her flowers and she got her moment of acknowledgement, which has not largely come yet in Russia.
Thank you. We need some brave person.
Paul, let me ask the first question.
Sure.
And Marianne, perhaps you could talk more about why it was important to tell the story through the eyes of women survivors.
Why women? It's a very good question. I think that for the most part, Gulag's story is famous nationally and internationally through the eyes of men. You know, we know Varlam Shalamov, we know Alexander Solzhenitsyn. There are films. There are there are many accounts, and there are very few women accounts. You know, there are no major films about women. They might be in the making in the future. There is Eugenia Ginsburg's The Whirlwind, Into the Whirlwind, but the memoirs, but they're not largely famous. And women's accounts and women's experiences are very, very different from male experiences, what I learned. I must say that this film is a short film technically, so this is the tip of the iceberg, what we showed. But what I discovered that the main tragedy of women in camps was losing the family. And what they actually suffered most is loss of a sister, loss of a father, a mother. A lot of them didn't get to get married or have children like Fokla or Levitska, so they dedicated the rest of their lives to the cause instead, like being an assistant trying to rehabilitate their compatriots. So it's just a different experience, and the story really has not been told. That's why we've been having quite a lot of good experiences screening this film worldwide educationally, because there is really nothing on video that would be contemporary and about this particular subject.
For those of you who don't know, if you want to ask a question, you get up and stand in front of a microphone, and then Eric will recognize you. Please.
The story of the gulags must be well known in Russia, given how many people were sent there. Given that, can you give us your thoughts on how they reconcile this popularity of Stalin, the nostalgia for the Stalinist times, with what they must know has went on during those times?
I think the must know is the knowledge is exaggerated, because I can only judge with what has been happening in the past maybe 20, 30 years. And I haven't been living in the country. So when I was growing up in Russia in the 80s and when I was a journalist in the early 90s, the whole truth just started really coming out. And Stalinism was condemned, but not to the end. You know, Lenin was never carried out of the mausoleum. Stalin is still buried on the Red Square, and it was very funny because Levitska, Solzhenitsyn's assistant, has a niece. And as I was screening the film to her in her house, she said, "Really, Stalin is buried near the Kremlin wall?" And Levitska said, "What, you didn't know?" And she said, "No, I didn't know." Children are not taught at schools. The history books during Putin's time has been rewritten. Stalin is portrayed as an efficient manager first, and then, there is a little bit of a small chapter about the atrocities, but it's only talking about sort of higher commandment being destroyed and nothing about the major crimes. So people are not educated.
Let me note that the sociological questionnaires tell us that like half of the young Russian people don't know anything about this. They don't know what the gulag is and so forth. It's our feeling that that Russian officialdom has more or less approved of our movie by showing it on network TV, because they have finally become concerned about these popularity ratings of Stalin as a protest against the current regime. So, oddly enough, we happened to come along at a time when we were very useful to the Putin regime, and the fact that this is going to be shown on networks, and they claim audiences of like 30, 40, 50 million people. So all of a sudden they've decided we're going to open this up. Now, one reason why the Russian people don't know as much as we think, and that is the returnees, when they came back, they were sort of scorned. They were, there was the uncle who somehow reappeared and he never left his room. So it was something to be ashamed of. And it was only with Solzhenitsyn and Memorial, et cetera, that there was this reaction. So it is amazing given the numbers. By my calculation, something like 20-30% of all families had someone in their family who was in the gulag or special settlement.
Amber.
Mariana, you've done a powerful job here in educating us on the realities of the gulags. Surely with this exposure, you must have some other things on your mind that you'd like to put the same talent to. Are there other things that you'd like to teach us from your experience?
We have been discussing, the projects that we might move on to with Paul. And I'm very interested in the subject of socialism. I don't know, so far it's just one word, but that would be maybe a series or a film or something that I'm not quite clear on, and something that I remember, something that I grew up with. It's not a story of my parents or grandparents, it's my story. And this is something that we're thinking about with Paul right now, as one of the many things that we have in the works.
Not only in Russia do people not know about this, but I don't think that we're basically being taught this in school today. Why do you think that is, even here in the U.S.?
That is a question for Paul, I think, because I'm not...
the question is, what is being taught in general in our schools? So I would worry much more about what our kids are being taught about, say, U.S. history. It's just, I think, it's a lack of attention to the rest of the world, which I believe has characterized us for a long time. But we have been approached to turn this into an educational teaching tool by victims of communism. So we'll see if they can do a short summary with questions for students and material for history teachers. So perhaps we can contribute a small amount to this issue.
But this film has been doing very well educationally because we screened it at maybe a dozen universities so far, Yale, Harvard, and Pomona, and Smith.
Maryland,
Vassar, and a couple in England. There was the University in Tartu. So, and there may be 50 scheduled throughout next year. So that educational market is very good for this film, and also the length because of the discussion. And I learned that, of course, people don't know. But an interesting point that I keep being asked from people who do know, that the portrayal here is very mild. They said, but the atrocities really in Gulag camps were horrific. If you read Shalamov's stories, you know, the women in camps were really slaves of slaves. It's unimaginable the cruelty that has been going on. And my answer to this was usually, I wanted this to be sort of PG-13, even though it's strange because in Russia they put 18 plus on some, you know. I said, why? You know, school children have to know about this. So I wanted people to be able to look at this without turning away from the screen, from the beginning to the end, not get bored, and sort of get the tip of the iceberg, and then if they're interested to read what really went on, they can, because it was really, this is really the tip of the iceberg.
Annalise.
Yes, it's a remarkable film. And I would like to ask about the forced labor camps as their role in the economy in building the Soviet Union, or whether they are just an expression of cruelty.
I've studied this for quite a while. There's a chicken and the egg. And the egg question, because did they open the camps because they had so many prisoners, or did they have so many prisoners because they needed them in the camps. The story I tend to ascribe to is that after collectivization and de-kulakovization put millions of people in prisoners in camps and special settlements, that's when the NKVD went to Stalin and said, "We got a great deal here. We have millions of people who will work for nothing, work for subsistence." And they came up with these very optimistic projections that you can produce an ounce of gold for 2 cents or something like that. None of these predictions worked out. And even before Stalin's death, Beria, who was really in charge of this, prepared a study which showed that the Gulag was a terrible loss-making activity. Even wanted to start the releases, but they couldn't release until Stalin. But most of the studies show, yes, there was this naive belief that they could make this prison labor very productive, but in reality it turned out to be a massive loss-making activity. So I hope that answered your question.
Hi.
On the right first, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hi, I just want to tell you a couple of reasons why I think Gulag is not recognized, basically. First of all, there was no process of re-Gulaganization, like there was a process of denazification. Okay, it was never acknowledged, only partially a little bit how it was expedient for political needs by Khrushchev and followers. But it was never an open, not even complete, an open discussion about that. And people who grew up during Stalin are still afraid to talk about that. For example, my parents, they would not talk about that. Okay, and so I was born after Stalin, but it's still when I was talking to my grandparents' parents, they would shrug from these details. They would not openly discuss, and yes, there was practically no family that was not affected by that, but it was a stigma.
Let me note that when Mariana presented this film in Moscow, you had a number of people who came up and said you were lying, correct? And one reason they gave was when Fjelkl is talking about sleeping and waking up with the frog in her mouth, that they said, "This is impossible. You made it up, and you're dealing with dishonest people." So did you get more of that, or only the one time?
We only had three screenings in Moscow. At every screening, there would be some Stalinist or somebody who would say, "You know, I'm an actor. I've been playing Stalin for 25 years. Can you really explain why you decided to make this film? You know, what is in it for you?" Sort of, you know, there were a couple of trolls, especially when we were shortlisted for an Oscar. There were a couple of sort of independent, not Kremlin, not official, but independent volunteer trolls who wrote mocking articles about us, which I was very proud that. We now have trolls.
On the left, please.
Hi. First of all, thank you for making this film. And the question is, are you going to make something more in the future? Because, it's great. It's like explains all this extremist woman. They actually never fought back in the prison. Because that's what usually extremists do, you know, they try to escape and all that stuff. How much I heard, it's in China going on right now, same thing, mm-hmm. What they call some kind of re-educational camp or something,
camps,
yeah. So in the future, you're going to make something like about China, maybe?
Perhaps we can touch upon it if we do a series about socialism.
About socialism, because China might be a part of it, North Korea, Cuba, okay. Russia,
about
you know,
socialism.
Exactly. But I think that as far as this particular subject, we jumped into the last wagon of the leaving train because all these women are dead, basically. So there is nobody, you know, that generation is gone. So these few years was the last chance. You know, I don't think it would be easy or possible to make a film like that anymore. So, no.
Well, thank you very much for making
sure,
it.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for making this film. It's really wonderful. It needs to be told for not only our current children, but also here in the U.S., but also in Russia. I'm curious, I've done a little research. I was actually in Karaganda. I've been in the mines actually there and also at Butova and so forth, and seen the real awful, awful situations there. But, you know, when the revolution happened in Russia, it was actually quite quick that things transpired quickly. In fact, I think it was in Lenin's Tomb, the book, that they were saying that some people returned to Russia after 10 years, they didn't recognize their country, and it was completely different. And I'm wondering what will be in the U.S. when we have 40, I think it was recent poll, 40% of young people think socialism is benign. And don't really understand any of this history, don't understand what it can lead to. What are the chances and what are your thoughts of this potentially happening in the United States and how do we guard against that? Thank you.
I will pass to Mariana on that one.
I think I should answer that I'm a filmmaker, not really a politician. So, what I made is sort of a historical document, a document of an era, and it can be it can provoke people to think, right, and inspire people to learn more and think, and this is my goal. My goal is not to go any further. I think, you know, Paul is a historian and an economist, and this is his domain more. I think my job is to make films. So I don't know if I'm prepared to answer
the
question.
I will give my answer. You are correct that. This didn't begin under Stalin. In fact, the second decree that Lenin signed after the revolution was the so-called Red Terror Decree, in which he went after all intellectuals. He either exiled them abroad, and those were the lucky ones, or he imprisoned them within Russia. And at that time, Russia lost many of its top intellectuals. Lenin and Stalin insisted on what they called Soviet thinking. That is, you're not going to trust a doctor, you're not going to trust a chemist, you're not going to trust an agronomist unless he is what they call a Soviet person. Soviet means, in thinking about things, you're going to base your thinking on what the party tells you to think. Now, if we talk about the United States, the possibility of something like that happening, I would say that's the danger if we're all forced to think in a particular way. Lenin understood this was the key to his dictatorship, and Stalin understood it even more. So, anytime we're in a situation where we're all being told to think in a particular way, and if we don't think that way, we're enemies, then we're getting close.
Yeah. Last question, please.
Yeah.
Thank you. I find it very interesting that in the beginning of the movie, you show the quote from Anna Akhmatova, then there are one person who is arrested and another person who is arresting, and they do look each other in the eye. Do you think exploring this topic of how society can, one part of society can allow these things to happen to another part of society, and what the relationship between these two forces, because I think both are victims of the regime.
I think this is exactly what we're witnessing now happening in Russia, because major issues that are going on in Russia politically now is a direct result of the fact that Stalinism was not condemned and that there was no Nuremberg trial over the criminals as they did in Germany. And if Hitler stood on the main plaza in Berlin, he would have been arrested, and Stalin's double can stay in the Red Square and be allowed. The excuse is that this history becomes a farce, and so this is just a farce or a kitsch. Why are you worried? But it's not just a kitsch, because this is very serious situation when there was no big apology and big moment of acknowledgement that has really not come in Russia. And I think what will happen, right now there is this juxtaposition, and I see it, in the democratic forces in Russia, the progressive opposition and the Putin regime, I think, which is a direct line of the KGB. So I feel that this is all related. And unless we work on the issues of the past, we cannot really move with the future. So what I did is practically a short film trying to deal with this, trying to just show, this particular segment. But yes, more films should be made.
So please join me in thanking Paul and Mariana.
And thank you for coming in this heat.
And there's a reception pavilion outside. If you'd like to join us there, please do. Thank you.